I have a quick shout out I have to do, but Mike Leonard has a rule that if he's on hold for more than 3 minutes, he hangs up the phone out of a personal grievance. So I have to get him in on the conversation too. Hey, Mike, how are you doing, buddy?
Hey, buddy, if that was the rule, I would be off the show. You know, you put me in hold for hours at a time, not 3 minutes. Come on, let's be honest here.
How's New York, by the way? What are you doing out there this weekend?
It's awesome. I want to thank WGN for sending me out here because this is where the stores are. I just need to know, who do I submit the expense report to after the weekend?
Ooh, I'll tell you who to CC. Mary Boyle, and you'll get an answer pretty quickly on whether those expenses are going to get paid or not.
I'm sure I will. Yeah, I'm actually visiting my son who's in college, and two of our other kids came along for the ride.
Oh, nice.
So it's fun. It's a beautiful day here. It's like sunny. Hopefully Chicago sunny as well.
Yep, we're, I think, experiencing the same thing after a deep freeze. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Mike Leonard is a federal defense attorney. Mike, you grew up in the area. Did you do speech or debate in high school or college?
I did not. You know, I think, obviously, when I was in college, they must have had speech. They must have had debate. I didn't do it. They had not invented mock trial at the college level. I think I would have enjoyed that. I didn't do mock trial until law school, which I loved, and that really fueled my zest for trying cases.
Well, then I wish you had said yes, because it would have made my next thing more poignant. But that's okay. You can listen to it anyways. I just want to give a shout out to all the fine competitors at the Illinois High School Association's individual events. That's the Speech Team State Championships happening today and yesterday down in Peoria. Mike, I did Speech Team in high school, and no surprise, I did the event Radio Speaking. I was runner-up
cool.
in the 2002 state final, second place. That still eats at me. There's so many other events. There's humorous events, comedic and dramatic, and they do poetry readings. There's 14 different individual events that go on there, and the speech team has continued to grow at Downer South and some other schools as well. And even if your kid doesn't end up wanting to do acting or speaking as like a profession, I could not shout out what speech team did for me and so many other people. A lot of lawyers come out of speech team because it just trains you at a really early age to talk in front of adults, to get critiqued on what you say, to get ranked. There's no participation trophies in speech team. You get ranked 1 to 6, and someone's got to be in last place. And Mike, it was just something as an experience as a 14 to 17 year old getting judged by adults and having to take those critiques and adjust how you present yourself. And in this day and age, with screens so prominent, the more and more kids, if you got kids or grandkids, get them into high school speech teams, because it is such an important thing. And I'd imagine, even though you didn't do speech and debate, you'd echo some of those sentiments.
Oh, 100%. I think at the high school level, college level, a law school level, all the things that gets you on your feet, and especially if you're being critiqued while you're on your feet and you get a chance to take a position, you know, you're forced to take a position. You don't get to choose it necessarily. I think it's fantastic for your development. In this competition, do they give you a position to take? How does it work?
That's a great question. There are 14 different events, and one of them is called extemporaneous speaking, where you pick out of a hat, really, from many different topics, and it's often a political of the day question, and you have 45 minutes to research it and present an 8-minute or 6-minute speech from memory, citing sources, and you do have to take positions on it, but you get to choose which side of the political or the geopolitical angle you want to take. That's one of the events. There's impromptu speaking, which is similar, but it could be a range of topics from a political thing to Indiana Jones. Who knows? My event that I do is radio speaking, where you actually prepare a news report in 45 minutes and deliver it later. The rest of them are more acting and interp. So there is a little bit of that take a side in some of the events that you have to do, and you have to be on the spot to do it.
Oh, that's got to be great. Okay, so the listeners always want to know more about John Hansen. Two questions.
Yep.
First of all, do you remember who you lost to?
Ryan Swearingen from Wheaton-Warrenville South. He's a urologist these days. Shout out to him. He was a sophomore when he beat me, but we kept in touch for years. He went to U of I later, and he'd like to poke fun at me at the bars, the fact that he beat me when he was 2 years younger than me. You're really opening up some wounds here. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a rumor that Bob Surratt dressed as a teenager and beat you in that competition. That's not true?
He absolutely would have. You know what's funny, though, Mike, is I have coached at Downers Grove South. There are some really active speech coaches who are teachers at the school and are there every single afternoon. I don't do that, but I get to help coach the radio speaker who ends up making it, hopefully, to state. And I have not gotten to have a chance to coach a state champion either. It's like a John Hansen curse. I've coached a couple second-place kids, but hopefully this year we crack to the number one spot, Mike.
Yeah, it's funny how those things stay with you. I'll come back to that point. But second question, is there a tape that exists somewhere of your performance in the high school competition that we could play in the radio for the listeners someday?
Had I won, yes, because the state champion gets to perform in front of the entire audience of thousands of people at the Peoria Civic Center. But as second place, those files have been lost to memory.
Wow.
I do have a tape, Mike, of me playing Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof on VHS, if you'd like to see that one day.
John, we got to play for the listeners. I mean, the questions about John Hansen's life, they just pour in. And I have to practice law, so let's just settle some of these issues,
okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But I do have a similar experience. When I was in law school, we had what's called the mock trial team, which is phenomenal. So you would basically try a case. You'd have a team of three, and you'd have a competition, like a regional competition. Ours was at the Daily Center in Chicago. And you went against all different law schools, right? Some of them from other parts of the country, some of them from Chicago. We came in, the two Loyola teams both advanced to the finals, but they decided, even there was no rule, that it wasn't fair for both teams to advance to the finals because that would be unfair, because then one Loyola team would go to the Nationals. So
right.
We got bounced on that basis. Only one team got to advance. And so we were a second-place finisher. I still remember it. I still remember the judge, who was a Cook County judge, who ruled against us, essentially said this other team won.
Wow.
And I still think about it, John. You know,
yes.
I'm so bitter.
It sticks with you. And that was a lot longer ago than it was for me. Quick little age joke.
Ooh,
there. Wow,
that's,
burn.
That's
sick.
That's a low blow, Mr. Hansen.
Mike Leonard here. Hey, we got a great question on the line. You're in New York right now, and it kind of relates to what we wanted to open the show with, besides us regaling our second place finishes over the years. And for that, we go to Matt. Hello, Matt. You're on WGN.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call today.
Yeah. What do you got for us?
So I was wondering if you guys had an opinion about, specifically with the Eric Adams case, the New York law that allows the governor to actually remove the mayor from office.
Right. And she is not going to do that. Kathy Hochul said she would not use her power to remove.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah, she's not going to do that, which I think is the right call. I'm not a lawyer, and I'll let Mike weigh in and give us maybe a little more context to the whole situation, too. I don't like recall elections, and I do not like when the governor has control over mayors. I think people elect people to terms, and there's something called a re-election. There's also impeachment proceedings that city councils can do. There's ways that you can remove people from the ballot, or from office. But I do not like any centralized person having that much power to sway either way politically, because the people of New York voted for Eric Adams to serve a term, and no matter how much you disagree with what might be happening in the federal court system regarding his case, I think that's a step too far. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I'd agree. I feel like for a lot of people, maybe when they have somebody in office that they don't like, they'd like to see a certain decision made in one way. But then it could always happen the other way. So I think it's kind of a dangerous precedent to be set in a lot of cases.
I agree. I'm going to put you on hold really quickly, Matt. You can listen. I'll come back to you, though. But Mike Leonard, you're out there in New York. What's the vibe?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. Just to bring listeners up to speed, because maybe not everyone is following as fervently as we are. But, you know, Eric Adams, the mayor, is facing still federal charges for corruption, bribery, false, you know, fake campaign contributions from people who are international citizens, et cetera. So, of course, the Trump administration, who now has control of the DOJ, has filed a motion to dismiss those charges, which we need to talk about more later. However, because of all the controversy that Adams has generated, there was a groundswell in New York to have the mayor invoke a New York law which allows the governor of the state to remove a mayor of a city, which is unbelievable to me. And so the word is that she's not going to do it. But think of what a dangerous precedent that is.
Yes.
You know, because it doesn't have a for cause standard or you committed a crime standard. So imagine the next governor who's of a different political persuasion decides to remove some mayor in some significant city because they want to, you know, for political purposes. So I think it's a great idea that she's not going to go forward with that. However, the vibe here is very interesting. As you can imagine, a place like Washington Square Park in New York City, where there's literally, I was walking through there this morning, huge protests, you know, first of all, against Adams, and then secondly, against Hochul, the governor, basically saying that she's gutless, you know, she should be removing him, we need to remove her. So it's really generating a lot of controversy, there's no doubt about it.
Anytime a mob is telling you to do something, I think sometimes it's the brave thing to not do it. That's just a broad statement there. I worry about precedent with all sorts of things. Like our democracy, I think we sometimes take for granted, thinking that it is a surefire thing. Certain guardrails like impeachment standards having to be very high to convict. I know that bothers a lot of people. I'm not bothered by it. Certain things that require three-fifths majority or three-quarters majorities in terms of amendments. I like those sorts of things, Mike, in our systems, and I feel like those are the things that hold the democracy, even if it isn't politically prudent to my personal beliefs in the moment.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a great point. I think a lot of people would agree with you. I mean, imagine a law if Pritzker could remove whoever he wanted throughout the state from the mayoral positions. I mean, people would be up in arms if that was one of our laws. But that's a New York law, and I'd love to know if any listeners have any input into when that law got passed, what's the history of it, and I'm assuming it's never been invoked.
Wait, we're the experts. We're supposed to have that.
No, we ask the listeners. We just spout off our opinions, and then we ask the listeners to give us the answers, John. Don't you realize how the show works?
Yeah. Let me just bring Matt in. Hey, Matt, that answer your question and thoughts? Any other follow-ups?
I agreed with that. Yeah, it's very interesting. Thank you guys for that.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Mike, hang on the line. I'm going to take a quick commercial break. I want to dive maybe a little bit more into that. We're getting some texts on the matter, too. I'm kind of curious what you all think. Should a governor be able to remove a mayor? And don't just put the current moment in time in your head. Think about what could happen the next mayor or the next governor, whatever the case may be. Calling in now, 312-981-7200. If you got any thoughts about the Eric Adams, Governor Hochul, and maybe even if you apply to Illinois, the idea of a governor being able to remove a mayor. Kathy Hochul says she's not going to do that. Mike Leonard, someone on the text line was upset that I even suggested that I don't like recall elections, saying that that's the ultimate democracy, the people being able to recall someone that they voted for, or maybe didn't vote for, but to bring them down. And Mike, I don't know what your thoughts are, and my worry is I sometimes want the person who's in that office to have to make unpopular decisions. That's, you know, we are a democracy, but in many ways we're a constitutional republic, and the idea of we elect people to make decisions for us. Sometimes unpopular decisions, while they may be a tough pill to swallow, end up being the right decision. Like if a mayor, and I'm not using the current example, but like if a mayor had to cut a bunch of salaries on the Chicago city budget and raise taxes, otherwise the city was going to be insolvent, that may be really a bad political decision to make and could be recalled. I don't want him or her to have to think of that when they're making tough calls. Does that make sense?
It's a good point. Yeah, I mean, I think the recall standard is usually very high. So the ability to recall is typically there, but the percentage vote you need to recall someone is usually really substantial. So recalls happen very infrequently, so I think that they are generally insulated from, you know, the political tides, but it does happen once in a while. It certainly has happened in California. I think it's a nice safeguard because the standard to recall is so high that it has to be super significant. So it's one you could certainly debate all day long.
Yeah. The example I always use is the Marshall Plan. I mean, the Americans hated it. Like, it was like 16% approval rating, yet Truman still did it, and it rebuilt Europe, and it essentially made Europe a stronger place and essentially our trade partner in a huge way. It's just one of those examples of, like, you don't govern by polls of certain topics. I mean, you could take it into consideration. It's just those are the sorts of things where I'm like, nah, that's why I want the leaders to make those decisions independent of maybe what a poll says they should do. We got a great point.
I think the counter is that, you know, if something is so significant to the electorate, they shouldn't have to wait. If they can get that incredibly significant vote to get you out, then maybe you should leave.
But there's mechanisms to get rid of people through impeachment, and you can, you know, convince the council people or if it's a governor, the state people, or Congress and the Senate for the president. Like, that should be what the groundswell is, doing it through those means which are already there.
Well, I'll let you take that position to get battered by the listeners, John. So maybe more text will come in.
Go ahead.
Speaking of coups, I just want to warn you. I know a guy's coming on the show today. I think you know his name, Patrick Dolan.
Yeah.
And I ran into him on the Kinko's on Clark Street, and he was printing shirts that said, "Let's get legal, the Patrick Dolan show." So just so you know what this guy's intentions are before he comes to the studio. I hope he can't hear me, but
I don't even know. I don't see him in the green room yet, so maybe he's late to his appearance here today. I don't know. Hey, before the news, I at least want to get Tim's question in. It's a good one. Hey, Tim, you're on WGN. What do you think? What are you wondering?
Hi. I've got a question about jury. Well, maybe two questions. I do have jury duty coming up. Not really very fired up about it. But, you know, when I was watching the news after the Madigan judgment, how many jurors were just speaking to the reporters right after the verdict was released. I didn't know. I thought that jurors were kind of sworn to some sort of secrecy, obviously not. And if that's not true, doesn't that kind of help the defense in a appeal? If they know what, you know, the jurors were thinking or what swayed them, and then they could try to avoid it in the future. I don't know. Just wondering about that.
That's a great question. Tim, we are up against the news. Can you hang on and listen to the answer right after the short news break, okay?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. All right, great. Mike Leonard, hang your thoughts there, too. That's really good stuff. Mike Leonard on the phone line. Patrick Dolan now in chair number two. We're going to let these guys overlap for a little bit. Patrick, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Mike, you still hanging in there in New York?
I'm here. I'm glad I warned you about Patrick before he got there.
Yes. No, thank you very much. We got a text from the 312, a very well-meaning text, and I do appreciate the feedback. Someone wondering why I have Mike, the expert, on, but all I do is give my opinions and sometimes talk too long, which, again, it's always – no, appreciate listener feedback. I'm just wondering, Mike, why are you texting the text line? You should just tell me in person. You could just tell me.
No, that's my son. My son's texting to complain about you. Yeah.
Right.
You should have my daughter do it. It must be my son today.
Yeah, it's surprising he wants to hear more of dad. Usually that's not the case.
No. And I do. I will say sometimes I listen to the radio going, I'm like, just let the expert do the talking. And I should remember that
sometimes.
Well,
you kind of know what you're talking about, John.
No, it's a fair
point. You're pretty good.
It's a fair point. I appreciate all the feedback from the listeners. Seriously, get involved in the conversation. We love that. 312-981-7200. That is what Tim did. Tim, you're still hanging on. You were summoned for jury duty, which you're not looking for. I want Mike to reflect on that in a moment. But your second question was what? Just remind the listeners.
Well, I was just kind of dumbfounded when I saw all the not all the jurors decided to talk, but several of the jurors after the Madigan judgment were all tied and talking immediately about the case. So I was just surprised. I thought there was some sort of secrecy. And then could that affect the appeals that are, I'm sure, going to happen?
That's a great question. Mike, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, great question. It brings up a couple issues. One, each district or each jurisdiction typically has a rule about whether the attorneys can talk to the jurors or not. In our federal court in Chicago, the local rule is that you can't, as an attorney, talk to jurors unless the judge specifically approves that. There's nothing that I'm aware of in our jurisdiction or any other that ever prohibits jurors from talking to third parties or the press about the case or about their deliberations. Tim brings up a great question. Well, these people are out there talking to the press. Is it going to raise issues that are going to be able to be used on appeal? The answer is basically categorically no, because once the verdict is done, the courts are almost never buy into deliberations or get into that. So anything they said to the press would never be a basis for an appeal. The only exception to that would be if the jurors were telling the press, hey, we conducted our own investigation, or hey, you know, we disregarded what the judge said. We're reading all about the case in the news. We found that persuasive. If they said something that would show that the process was tainted, then that might give fodder to the defense. But them talking about their deliberations, how they reached their conclusions, what the split was, you know, what they thought was important evidence, all that's fair game. They can talk about it all day long. The only way the defense would get any benefit is if they said something that led to a kind of uncovering of that there was something tainted about the process itself, which would have to be something significant, such as doing your own investigation,
right,
not listening to the judge, talking about it before you're supposed to, reading about it, you know, all that sort of stuff. But even then, it's tough to get an appellate court to revisit a jury verdict. But those were the types of things that would have to be said. But all the stuff these people were saying to the press, which was surprising, I agree with Tim, all fair game, and it's not going to help the defense on appeal at all. probably to their chagrin.
Plus, I think it helps keep the process open and honest in a way. I think it's jurors are private citizens, right? They go in there, they do their thing, they don't say anything while they're going through that process to each other, to the press, and then they're just like you and me, or Tim maybe soon with his jury service if he goes, if he ends up being picked. Like, there's something about the openness that I think keeps it all on the up and up.
Yeah, interesting point. I mean, some people have a problem with it because they feel like in a major case like Madigan, if jurors are thinking about the fact that they're going to be talking about it afterwards or going to be talking to a reporter or going to try to do a news article or book about it, that might taint it if they're allowed to go do that afterwards. But it really just comes down to, I think, a free speech issue. And I've never seen a jurisdiction that barred jurors from communicating with the press or other parties. The only restrictions come in terms of what the attorneys are able to do or not do with those jurors.
That's Mike Leonard. He's a federal defense attorney. Patrick Dolan's an employment lawyer. Sometimes might need to go to trial for some things. Tim has some apprehension about jury duty. I wanted your opinion, Patrick, on why people should put on their big boy pants and go do it. I don't know how else to say it, right? I mean, it's not necessarily the most fun thing, but it is like
I hate to say it's an obligation, but it sort of is.
It is an obligation.
Yeah, but I mean, it has some negative consequences. But you know what? You got to do it. I mean, it's just the way our system works. If you didn't do it, somebody else is going to have to do it. And if they have a problem, it could be a bigger issue. I mean, the fact of the matter is, for those of us served, I was honored to do so, and it was interesting, and I just felt like we all have to do it.
You were on a jury?
I was.
Oh, wow. I've not been called yet.
Yeah.
I'm always wanting to do it, if nothing else than just to talk about it on this program. That would fill a good half hour. My experiences in the jury. I think people always maybe have apprehension. And, Mike, you can come on this too. We've talked to jurors before on the show. I think people have apprehension thinking it's going to be maybe a multi-week. They're going to be put in the hotel. They see, like, the OJ trial, and I think they think that might be what they end up doing. But, Mike, even in your experiences, for the most part, these are a couple days, maybe a week, mm-hmm. not sequestered situations, right?
Correct. I mean, sequestration happens like one in a million, literally. Even some of the largest cases we've had, the jurors have not been sequestered. They certainly weren't sequestered in Madigan. But, yeah, it's a very common thing. Everybody I know who gets a jury summons is always talking to me, I got to go. You know, what do I do? I think, agree with Patrick, it is super important. We don't want jury service to be, you know, only for people who, you know, oh, gee, I have the time. I'm retired or I'm in school. You know, we don't want it just to be one subsection. We want to get a cross section of all the people. And the funny thing is, John, as you know from your show, when we've had a show devoted on jury experiences, jury stories, listeners, they love it. I mean, most people enjoy the experience. They talk about it for a long time. They actually usually form some solid bonds with their fellow jurors. So, look, I understand, like, who wants to, you know, you're busy, you got work, you know, you're going to have to work at night, all that stuff. I get all that stuff, but we really need it, and that's really the only way the system works.
Well said. And if I always kind of think, although I haven't gotten the letter yet, if I was apprehensive or came at a busy time, first of all, if there's a real medical or something going on, odds are the judge is going to dismiss you. They try to accommodate and get people into the service that are able to do so, for the most part, is at least my understanding of it. But it's also like, what if I was eventually innocent of something? Of course, I would be innocent of it. Mike Leonard's defending me, so I'm already fighting an uphill battle. And I just want jurors who want to be there or want jurors who are open-minded to it. And so maybe I need to be that person in case I'm ever on the other side of things.
Oh, no doubt. And, you know, you raise a good point. During the jury selection process, a lot of people are excused medical reasons. They already have a prepaid vacation. They don't have any child care, things like that. That happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's why the pool that comes into the room at the beginning is often winnowed down significantly, right? And sometimes they even need more of a pool to be able to fill the jury. So all those types of things, those emergency situations, they're certainly accounted for.
815 says, jury duty was great. Look forward to doing it again because it was a really great learning experience. Yeah. I wish on their way out you could leave like a comment card and be like, call me again. That was wonderful.
Well, I also think for most people, you've seen it in a TV series or a movie or something like that. And so you're really curious about in reality whether it matches that or it's different. Or, you know, most trials are a couple days. I mean, Mike would agree. I mean, and they really don't take that much time. And I think it's really interesting.
And I will say, having been a fan of many movies and TV shows around the courtroom. I went and saw Mike Leonard do his mm-hmm. thing once in a courtroom, and it was exactly like Billy Flynn from Chicago. He had a three-piece zoot suit on, tap danced around, broke out in song. It was a wonderful experience.
I'm not surprised.
And I won. It was a not guilty, right?
Yes, exactly. She didn't hang, right? This was the 1920s, exactly.
He wasn't wearing his Iowa sweatshirt?
No, he was not. Okay. He actually dresses up. It's really great.
Wow.
Although every new attorney always dresses up for their first appearance here on Let's Get Legal, and then they get the vibe when they see that I'm in a hoodie and realize it's Saturday
downhill.
Afternoon.
It's all downhill from there.
Yeah, we don't have to wear suits. Mike, you wore a suit the first time you were here, I think.
Wow.
I think. I was trying to impress you. Then they realized, you're there in a ripped T-shirt. You don't care what I have to say.
It's Saturday.
You're charging me.
Your Money Matters is when you get the button up, John Hansen, Monday through Thursday. Saturday, sweats sometimes. Yeah. We have a new lawyer in today who I'm looking forward to meeting, Millie Palmer from Navigant Law, at around 2:30. So I did at least wear jeans today to at least be presentable for the picture.
As opposed to?
Like sweatpants?
No,
Patrick Dolan.
Sorry.
Mike, we've fallen off the rails a little bit. You want to hang on a little longer or you got to go?
Sure. Can I do one more segment?
Sure. Yeah.
Will Dolan allow me to share the stage with
him? I'd love to, Mike.
All right. And we got some questions, too, on the phone line. So one more break here before we get to the 2 o'clock news. Patrick Dolan right there. Mike Leonard in New York joining over the line. Patrick Dolan, our employment lawyer, bouncing in the chair right next to me, back in town from California, where he was working.
I was.
Not on vacation. Working vacation.
Most of the time working.
Yes. Access to hiking, things along those lines. Got a couple texts before I get to Jeannie. 630 says, I was on a grand jury in Kane County. It lasted 14 weeks, but just every Tuesday. Every Tuesday. I enjoyed it. It was fortunate that my employer paid me for my civic duty. Yeah, and I think, and actually, great question. Full-time employees are entitled to jury leave, right?
They are.
Patrick?
Yes. Well, whoever I am, yes they are. I'll answer that one.
Yes. Is it always paid or no? Is there certain hours that might be paid?
Most companies... it's certain hours that are paid with a maximum. Most companies will pay you for that jury duty. Unless it's really long, then no. But every company has a policy allowing you, whether you're paid or not, it's different.
Some of them can subtract what you make from the jury duty from their payment, right?
Yeah.
Like if you make $50 that day, they subject $50 from what they pay you.
Yeah, companies don't do that, though.
Okay.
Like, not in my experience. Jeez, that is really bad.
Patricia says, John, serving on a jury is a privilege of being an American. At least so far. That's from Patty, yeah. Well said, Patty. Okay, let's go to Jeannie. Jeannie, what's your thought on today's conversation?
I had always wanted to serve on a jury, and I got called to jury duty. I have a service dog, and I made it all the way to Wadier. He's very well trained. He's a corgi, and we made it all the way to Wadier. And the prosecution attorney asked me what my dog's name was. And his name is Boo Radley from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, my gosh.
By the time the D was out, he's like, dismissed.
Wait, why?
The prosecutor wanted you dismissed or the judge dismissed you?
No, the prosecutor. I believe it was the prosecutor because the defense would want a Boo Radley.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, okay, so for those who don't know, To Kill a Mockingbird, he
couldn't say it fast enough. So as long as I have him, we will probably not be on a...
Just make up another name that the other side would hate.
Wait,
I don't know what
you've
else.
You've given people some ideas here.
You're not allowed to lie.
Oh, that's true. Very good. Thank you, Jeannie, for calling me out on that. Mike, what are your thoughts on that? That's wild.
Well, that's pretty wild. That's funny. I mean, that's hilarious. I mean, lawyers bounce jurors for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes they're obvious where someone really just expresses a particular bias or position where you kind of know where they're coming from. Other times, it's just sort of a gut feeling, like I get a bad vibe from that person, or I think they're against me, or they're not going to be good for my client, with really no legitimate, empirical rationale for it, but just how you feel. So I feel for this potential juror. That's pretty funny. I would want her to change her dog's name legally before the next time to what sounds like a prosecution-friendly name so that she can get, we can get a good juror for the defense.
That's
but
so
I don't
wild.
Like you encouraging her to lie, John. I mean, come on.
No, that was wrong. That was wrong. Show. I shouldn't have done that. I'm like just trying to think of like what could, like, is Boo Radley, I guess I get. It's not, though, like as if it was like a January 6th case and your dog was named Stopped the Steal or something, like where you'd be like, okay, that's a little on one side, clearly. Like I could see that being, but not to go back in history. I didn't
mean to. My mantra, John, these prosecutors are just too uptight. Us defense lawyers are are real people. These prosecutors are too uptight, John. That's the issue.
Let's go to the phone line. Oh, Jeannie, thank you so much for the phone call. That was great. Let's go to Bob. Bob, you're on WGN. What's up?
How you doing, gentlemen?
Great.
I seem to be a prime candidate as a juror. I've been called, and I've been serving on four juries.
Whoa.
Two of them were criminal. One of them was kind of a heinous criminal. One of them was a drunk driving one, and another one was a civil case with a nun who was being sued.
Okay.
And she was a doctor also.
Oh.
You know, I mean, what do you mean? Why are they...
Why are you always called?
I was going to say.
Yeah,
well, also,
exactly.
I got to ask. Yeah, so you were called four times and you served on three juries total or four?
No, I've been called really more than four times, but I've been selected four times.
Jeez.
Maybe
you
just look like an honest guy.
Yeah, you're just someone that they want.
Right.
Something about you. Get a dog named Boo Radley, Bob.
I think that's a compliment.
Well, I mean, just curious. Do they have like a criteria that they you know, look at a person and say, well, I like this guy.
Who I interested
for whatever reason.
Patrick, any thoughts? Then I'll go to Mike.
Well, I'm just wondering, like, what he says he does and his interests and all that kind of stuff. Because it's sort of like you're looking for the guy down the middle, or the woman down the middle, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just don't want anything that's sort of a red flag from one side or the other. But I'm curious as to what Mike would say.
Yeah, Mike.
Well, I'd love to ask some demographic questions because a lot of lawyers make a lot of assumptions or make decisions based on a lot of generic demographic information. So sometimes the judge in a particular case or jurisdiction gives the attorneys a lot of time to develop a lot of information during the voir dire process. Others don't, right? So sometimes you're left with very generic information off of a written juror questionnaire or just sort of basic questions you're allowed to ask them verbally. I mean, do you have, for example, contacts in law enforcement? Do you have family members who were or are in law enforcement? What's your background? Those are the types of things that might give you a clue in terms of why lawyers would be making sort of guesses about whether you'd be good or bad for their case.
So someone like maybe middle income, middle age, suburban, I'm not calling you average,
Bob, or what
too. You do, like just a job that's not controversial or wouldn't ping any things, those people might be more frequently called, not called, but actually to serve on the jury.
Yeah, look, if you're a prosecutor and a potential juror is telling you, I got four cousins who are cops with CPD, my dad was a cop with CPD, you know, blah, blah, blah. A lot of prosecutors are going to think, hey, this is going to be a favorable person for us. A lot of defense lawyers are going to immediately assume this guy's horrible for us. Get rid of him. You know what I mean? So those kind of generic assumptions, which may have no basis in reality, but in the absence of having other information or insufficient information, are, you know, kind of ready ways for lawyers to make assumptions or come to conclusions whether they think a juror's good or bad for them.
Mike, I got to get going. I got to let you go to the news. But first, give us your phone number. How can people reach Mike Leonard, Leonard Trial Lawyers?
312-380-6559. And thanks a lot. Enjoy, Patrick. Enjoy.
Thanks. Yeah. See you soon, buddy.
And just remember, put defense lawyer. You don't need to remember his name. You're going to need that number in a pinch. And when you need it, you don't want to be going, what was that guy's name? So everyone open up the contacts on your phone. Put in defense lawyer or defense
Best.
Lawyer Mike if
Best
you want to. Ben's well, I don't want to confuse people even more. So just defense lawyer. 312-380-6559. Take care, Mike, okay?
Take care, guys. Appreciate it.
Now, here's John Hanson, and let's get legal.
We already kicked Mike off the show. Patrick sticks around, and then we'll meet Millie a little bit later on. Patrick Dolan, did you do speech or debate in high school?
No, I did some theater.
You did theater?
Yeah, I did theater, yeah.
Okay,
I really
good.
Enjoyed it.
I appreciate that, because Mike didn't do any of those things.
No.
And it didn't lead very well into my segue.
What did he do? Or should we even ask?
He did moot court at some point.
Oh, yeah, I did that in law school, sure.
Yeah.
Which was fun.
Right. But so I was, the segue to all this is shout out to all the speech competitors at the state speech tournament in Peoria right now. Just found out Donners Grove South's Sebastian, who I coach, made it to the state final round in radio, which is coming up in a little bit. I'm a nerd about all things speech and debate. I did it in high school, and I brought up in the first hour that there's so many lawyers that come out of these events because presenting things to adults is in the wheelhouse of an eventual lawyer. And I'm not at all surprised you did theater.
Yeah, I'm not. Listen, it's sort of great preparation in a lot of ways, just presenting material and connecting with folks and just getting up there and doing it. I think it's great.
It's a grind, too. The season starts in like September, October. It's every Saturday. These tournaments are sometimes 10 hours long. You get up super early, get on a bus, you go do them. And I tell you what, if you're a parent and you got a kid approaching high school, or you're a grandparent, or if you happen to be listening and you're just about to go to high school or in there, if your school has a speech team, join it.
100%. Or debate. Right.
Whatever. Because especially these days, the people that get ahead in the worlds after college are people that can communicate. With so many people now staring at our phones, adults are guilty of it too as well. We are losing some of that communication presentation aspects. And if a kid wants to be super prepared, and it doesn't matter if they end up as a lawyer or whatever, it could be anything. Going into a job interview after you spent 4 years in high school being criticized or critiqued or told how to do things better, presenting information, what a skill set to have in those job interviews.
And also, it's something AI is not going to replace.
1,000%.
Yeah, that's never going to happen.
I was going to say 1,000%. Maybe 99%.
Yeah, okay. We got what you meant.
I don't think so.
It's highly unlikely. Well, good for Sebastian. That's exciting.
Very excited. And
when's the final?
It's right now. I mean, he'll go into the room. So the way radio speaking works is an event. He's actually got into the final in two events. He's a dramatic actor as well. Him and his scene partner got in too. So the way radio works is it's cool. And I'm sure some listeners are like, why is this guy going on about speech? But I'm such a nerd about it. I did it. And I love it as an activity. Is that they give you a giant packet of news and you have 45 minutes to literally cut, paste and write a 5-minute news script that then you deliver live over a microphone to judges in another room who listen to a news report. And you have to hit like 5 minutes on the dot. So you literally have like a manila folder and you cut out stories, you tape them in, you write, you edit them, you put together a sports, weather, news, like what Rob was doing. Now, Rob's a professional, of course, but it's these kids that do it. And it's so thrilling to watch them put together a new speech, a new report every single time they do this event. So that's
super impressive.
It's really cool.
And stressful and fun.
Yes. I tell you what, as a coach, and again, the real coaches are there every day. I just get to kind of pop in on the phone and help out with the one kid. These other coaches teach all these kids. I am more stressed now as a coach, and this probably doesn't bode well for being a parent. I'm more stressed than I was when I did it myself, which I think is probably something parents can relate to. Like watching your kid, my mom would always watch both my brothers played high school and college football. Every game, her fingers were over her eyes watching.
That's going to be you.
Yes, probably. But when you're doing the sport as a kid, you're like, this is fine.
I know.
So that's great news. So congrats to Sebastian.
So you just have to watch your phone to see what happens.
I do. Actually, I can watch the live. They put the live stream of the awards on, but not till like 6 or 7 tonight. Okay. Patrick, how are you?
I'm great. Great.
You're an employment lawyer of Conti and Dolan Law.
Aaron Conti's my partner.
What's in the news about employment law nowadays?
Well, everyone's read a lot about those federal employees getting laid off.
I heard you on Lisa Dent's show this week talking about that.
Talking about it a little bit. The sort of the problem still is we don't have a lot of definitive information about which departments are going to, actually end up laying off federal employees. I know some are trying to get folks back already.
Yes.
So some of it's hung up in the courts.
I just want to point out what has to come back. They fired some folks that were working on our nuclear weapons defenses that they have asked to come back. I've also been hearing that they fired some temporary IRS employees in the middle of tax season, and they are now asking them to come back. And look, I'm not making a blanket value judgment on DOGE. No doubt there is waste in certain government agencies, and audits should take place. I think a lot of people are just saying, whoa, maybe some of these things are happening too fast, too furious, without the proper, maybe proper is not the right word, but the diligence that sometimes we make sure that these mistakes aren't happening.
And I also read, John, that President Trump told Elon Musk today to get more aggressive with his cuts. And so, I don't know.
It is tough.
Some of these folks are represented by unions. I mean, we have to go through a lot to determine exactly who and how many will ultimately be laid off.
I wonder if, the judicial system is a great system that we have here in this country, but it is notably slow. And for things like employment law, like things that are for federal cases or for high profile state cases, the wheels adjust to turn slowly, and that's okay. But when you're laid off or when you're considering a buyout, waiting for a court decision is not something that is something that you can do, right?
No, it's not. And it's, employment litigation or any sort of administrative action, like with the EEOC or the Illinois Department of Human Rights, or to the Department of Labor. These things take time. I tell my clients all the time, when we file a charge with the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, it's got to go through a process that takes weeks and months to work through.
Are you hearing from any federal employees who maybe have not been laid off yet or been affected, but are really kind of seriously considering what they should do about their future careers in the federal government or government work?
Oh, absolutely. And what they're doing almost exclusively is not looking for jobs in other federal or state agencies. What they're trying to do is look in the private sector. And, you know, which I talked about a little bit with Lisa Dent, like, where are these people going to go? You know, the job market in the private sector is pretty tight. A lot of industries are pretty tight, and they're still laying off some people. Not as much as before in my experience, but I'm still talking to folks about separation agreements who are part of private company layoffs. So, John, it's, you know, very disconcerting.
Yeah, I think people think the job market, oh, it's going so well, and the unemployment number is great, and the number of layoffs isn't spiking in any noticeable way, but the number of job openings has really cratered, meaning companies are just tightening their belt and probably not doing additional hiring. So it's not one that can absorb a lot more
people.
That's
exactly my point. Where are these thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people going to be absorbed? State government jobs? Probably not, frankly. So we're in the private sector, and that's, you know, something to watch.
And again, not a value judgment. Some people might say, well, tough. No, welcome to the private sector. Like, we're spending too much on employees, and there's too many of them. That's one side of the coin. The other side is then you have a lot more unemployed people, and that has ramifications for the economy and potentially for political ramifications as well. But again, no value judgment on the decisions.
No, I'm just saying that's the reality. Where are these people going to go?
630 says, if my retirement age is 67, would that also be the age for collecting unemployment? I'm 64. I might get laid off. Any thoughts on that? We could also take a break if you want to do a little research on how long can you claim unemployment for? Does it matter the age?
No, it doesn't matter your age. If you qualify because you're unemployed, then you'll be paid for a certain amount of time. It's all state law. In Illinois, you can have up to around a year. I'll confirm that. But, you know, I don't. When he says 67, what is he referring to?
Maybe the Social Security age, or maybe something like
well,
that.
No. If you qualify for unemployment, you'll get unemployment. But remember, you're not going to qualify for a really long time under unemployment. It has a limitation period. Every state has a limitation period.
For how long you can stay on
it. Yes, exactly.
It's extended maybe under COVID,
and
but right now.
Because there's eligibility requirements that only last so long.
So if you were like 75 and working full-time still, and you're obviously collecting Social Security at that point, you're taking your RMDs at that point, but some people keep on working. Yeah. If you get laid off, you can still qualify for unemployment.
Yes, you should. If you should be eligible for unemployment.
Doesn't matter if you've reached a retirement age.
No.
Let's take a break here. If you have any other employment questions, we always get a lot of them. 312-981-7200. Call in right now. You can also call Patrick Dolan on Monday, 312-332-7800. Take more of your questions after this on WGN. Patrick, we got a few texts about the Social Security and all these sorts of stuff as well. Someone wanted to know, 630, when do state and government workers qualify for a pension? Boy, that probably varies on a lot of things, right?
It does. It depends on who they're working for and then how long they've been there and also what job they do. So all those things factor into. There's no one universal answer, John, I guess is the point.
Right. Like teachers are different on tier systems, firefighters
pensions
as well, mm-hmm, versus employees as well.
I'd be happy to talk specifically with that person about one that may be relevant to them, mm-hmm, and answer that question, but it really depends.
Someone wanted to know, if you get Social Security, usually you get reduced unemployment benefits. I am literally doing a Google search, and they said that can happen depending on the state. I'm still trying to rush and look up on Illinois what the situation is, whether you get reduced unemployment benefits if you are getting Social Security payments. But even still, you are eligible for them.
Yeah, that's not going to change your eligibility. It may change the amount you get paid, but your eligibility has nothing to do with Social Security benefits.
Yeah, I want to look deeper into that before, mm-hmm, I say that definitively. So I hope to get an answer here before 3 o'clock. Someone brought up an interesting text about trimming the fat off of government and understanding the mission, but maybe having a problem with the methodology. They said people are in fear. I know several people that are afraid. They don't know what the future brings. I'm thinking of my grandchildren. Why do they have to scare people in such a way and then put things back? Why can't they just gradually trim? I'm sure that's as much a political question as it is an economics one, trying to show what you've done so far for me, potentially, like they want to show cuts quickly, and maybe that's why they are rushing through things that, and then retroactively have to do it. But the idea of scaring employees, I mean, it really has rattled people. And I know some people say, oh, you've been on the government's payroll for too long. And look, there's waste in government. But these are people's lives that have jobs and support families, most of them.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, there's probably waste in the private sector, too. I don't think that's really the point. And frankly, that kind of broad brush statement, I think, doesn't do anybody any good. I think, listen, in the private sector, there's a lot of guardrails, right? I mean, because you have people like me looking at who's chosen for the RIF. You know, why is it occurring at a certain time? Are there legitimate business reasons? Are folks being selected improperly for discrimination reasons or retaliation? Why are they included? There's a lot of stuff we look at in the private sector. And so I don't know how much pushback there's going to be with these federal employee RIFs or layoffs or furloughs, depending on how they categorize these things. I'm sure there will be folks looking at for the same sort of things. But it does seem to me, as an employment lawyer, that it's a little bit more indiscriminate when you do it that quickly. Because, John, a RIF in a company, a large RIF, takes weeks and months to prepare for.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're analyzing stuff that I would look at. Are you including folks in minority groups who should not be included, or females, or, like, you know, all those sort of things that we look, that you analyze before you lay a bunch of people off?
And that's just from a legal perspective, let alone, like, can the company still operate with 5% of its workforce cut? Let's plan on where these cuts are going to come from, which departments, which that. And I imagine that a federal government, I know it's not a private company, but may operate in similar ways, where if you lose 70% of your staff in one office, the 30% can't pick up the weight.
And so when I look at these federal government layoffs, when you're saying to a department head, lay off 5, 7, 8% of your workforce, just do that. Okay, I get that. Then you have time to work through those sorts of issues that I would be concerned about as an employment lawyer. When you're just cutting numbers, which it seems like they're doing a lot lately, mm-hmm. then who's analyzing that? Where's the time spent to analyze whether it's being done properly? Listen, I don't know whether it is or isn't. It just seems when I'm reading it, this would not be how it is in the private sector.
Right. And I think that counters maybe the argument of, hey, this is how it works in the private sector. You're saying, no, it doesn't work this way. It doesn't work this quick. There's planning. There's time that goes into
typically
it.
Typically, there is.
That's true. Sometimes, not
all the time, but typically there is.
Yeah.
When we're talking about such large numbers, and we are talking about large numbers.
Yes. I mean, we have a $36 trillion debt as a country.
Oh, I understand why they're doing it. I just
I guess what I'm saying is, it's just there's in order to square that circle of a $36 trillion mm-hmm. debt, there's going to have to be cuts in some places. I don't know where. There's going to have to be revenue gained from some places. I don't know where. So I think it's naive to think that we just operate as if nothing is wrong when there's a $36 trillion debt. And here I go wading into politics, and someone's going to say, stop giving your opinion, John.
Yeah, no, I'm just looking at it from an employment lawyer's perspective. It just seems to be done very quickly, and I don't know who's looking at these things closely before they're being done.
Who else is, or what else are people calling you about, Patrick Dolan?
Still non-competes.
Really?
Yes, because non-competes are still valid and enforceable in Illinois, and so people call me all the time. I want to get this other job. Let's walk through it. Can I do this? Is a competitor? And what if I'm not doing exactly the same thing?
Which is good questions. I'm glad they're asking you instead of just doing it.
I know, because what happens is, it could happen. You can get the other job. The old employer could say, hey, you can't work there, and then you're fired from the new job.
Does that happen?
A lot.
Okay, so that's what I want to get at. Some
yes.
people say, I know it's enforceable, but they'll never enforce it.
Yeah, well, you're taking a big risk, frankly.
And so it does happen.
Yeah, well, it happens that companies don't enforce it, but it happens that they do. And so they'll, you know, send the new employer a letter saying, hey, you hired this person who violates this non-compete. Maybe the new employer didn't even know they had a non-compete. You know, you really want to walk through these issues before you take steps. That's why I really like it when people call me and say, I'm thinking about this job. Can I do it with it? And if so, how do I go about it to minimize my risk?
312-332-7800 is Patrick Dolan's phone number. That's a great question. If someone violates a non-compete, does their former employee sue the employee or the employer of their new boss?
They could do both. And oftentimes, they'll notify the new employer, but only sue the employee because they think they have better leverage against the employee. In other words, they're trying to drive a wedge between the new employer and the employee who has left.
Right, exactly. Patrick Dolan, 312-332-7800. Thanks for riffing with Mike Leonard for a little bit. Thanks
My pleasure.
For talking employment law as well. Have a good rest of your day and
All right,
week.
Buddy. Okay. Thanks. Take-